Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and thank you for joining me on this edition of our English feature program. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Coming up in just a few moments, church leaders in Britain appeal for prayers and for vigilant behaviour in the wake of three attempted bomb attacks in London and Glasgow. English Cardinal Cormac Murphy O'Connor discusses other challenges facing the new British Prime Minister, Gordon Brown. And as Pope Benedict issues a letter calling for unity among Chinese Catholics, we take a look at how the church in Hong Kong is marking the 10th anniversary of the handover to Chinese rule. Welcome to the programme. Catholic leaders in Britain have been calling for prayers and for vigilant and responsible behaviour following the two foiled bomb attacks in London and the attack at Glasgow Airport on Saturday. Security remains high across the nation as police continue the hunt for information about who was behind the attempted terror attacks. Two cars packed with explosives were discovered by police in central London on Friday, while a jeep loaded with gas cylinders crashed into the doors of Glasgow Airport's main terminal and burst into flames on Saturday. In a short statement on Sunday, the Bishop of Paisley, Philip Tartaglia, in whose diocese the airport is located, offered prayers to all staff and passengers using the terminal, as well as praising the swift action of police and security staff at the scene of the attack. In a similar statement, the Catholic Archbishop of Birmingham, Vincent Nichols, encouraged people to turn to God and pray for special protection for all who travel at this time. Archbishop Nichols also urged people to be particularly vigilant for the safety of others and said he would be discussing these latest events when he meets with other faith leaders in Birmingham later this week.
I think people in this country are very aware of the particular risks that surround us at the moment, and the Prime Minister asked people to be vigilant, and what I wanted to do was just remind people of the practice of praying for a safe journey and asking God's protection on each other at a time of risk. And I know that that will find an echo in many people who might come across this statement who might not be Catholics but members of other faiths, because praying for a safe journey is part of a tradition that is wider than the Christian faith.
What would you describe as the mood of people in Britain in the wake of these foiled attacks over the weekend and over the past few days?
Well, I think at one level, people are both anxious and curious as to what has happened in these three different locations. But at a pragmatic level, we get on and we just carry on, and I don't see any change in people's attitude or patterns. They're going to be more vigilant, they're going to have to be more patient because airport routines have been changed. But I would say everybody here just says we're not going to be put off, we're going to carry on with our way of life, and we'll do so in a determined and a vigilant way.
What can you tell me about the media reaction to these attempted attacks? Would you say that there's been a responsible reporting of these events or not over the past few days?
Well, I haven't made a study of the newspapers or the television, but of course, one of the characteristics we have at the moment is of constant news coverage. So it's easy to hear too much about the events. But on the whole, I would say, yes, it's been very responsible. There hasn't been gross speculation, and I think there's a soberness about the response and the need for the police to get on and make their investigations. Obviously, people are very thankful that nobody has been hurt seriously, apart from one attacker in Glasgow, and that two very tragic incidences, in fact, were averted.
We understand nonetheless that none of the suspects that the police is currently questioning is British in origin. Do you expect this may provoke some kind of xenophobic reaction or not?
Well, I think we need to know quite a lot more yet. And I would hope that the reaction will be clearly focused on where the problem lies and not generalize across the wider communities. I think, for example, in Birmingham, there are good relationships between the different sections of the Muslim community and with political leadership and with the police. So I would not expect a kind of rather thoughtless reaction right across different groups of people to be the consequence of this. I think it's too early to comment on who the police might be holding, because we simply don't, I don't know.
Is there anything else you feel that you and other church leaders can do at this time when people are clearly concerned about their security?
Well, on Wednesday now this week, I have one of our regular meetings with the leaders of all the faiths in Birmingham, and we will reflect on it. But I would imagine what would be our mood would be to appeal to people to stay calm, to be vigilant, to ask God's protection on each other and on our country, and to be alert to what's going on around them in a sensible and an intelligent way.
My thanks there to Archbishop Vincent Nichols of Birmingham in England. Failed attacks come just days after former Chancellor of the Exchequer Gordon Brown took over as the new British Prime Minister last week. The son of a Scottish Presbyterian minister, Brown took over as head of the British government after serving for 10 years as right-hand man to his close friend and colleague Tony Blair. Moving into No. 10 Downing Street with his wife Sarah, Brown said his priorities would be education, health and restoring trust in British politics.
There are obvious priorities for an incoming Prime Minister. People would be urging him on health and on education. I would be urging him on things like, I think, the family and the help and support he can give for the primacy of family in the social life of Britain.
As Archbishop of Westminster, Cardinal Cormac Murphy O'Connor is watching closely to see what changes the new Prime Minister will be introducing and what sort of relationship he will look to create with religious leaders in Britain. The day after Gordon Brown took up his new job, I sat down with the Cardinal to discuss some of the challenges facing his government, as well as the legacy left by his predecessor, Tony Blair.
I do think that the voice of the Church, and indeed of many others, on matters of human dignity, on matters of the family, on matters also, I think, to allow freedom in our secular society for religious people, Christians and other faiths, to be free not only to practice their religion, but also to contribute in the public forum to the common good.
There have been some notable tensions with the government over recent months, haven't there? How would you perhaps characterise this current stage of relations between the Church, the Catholic Church particularly, and the government?
Well, we've had some tensions of recent times concerning adoption agencies, concerning schools and the threat to our schools in the sense of having complete control over them. And these have been quite very strong, really. And in a way, the two issues illustrate two very important principles. The question of the adoption agencies is really a question of the primacy of the family, Catholic views about the best way to bring up children, and our conviction that to treat a homosexual couple as the same as a heterosexual couple is just would not be right. Now, it's important we say that, we say it clearly, and I think a vast number of people in Britain would agree with this, not in any way being homophobic. One doesn't want to be like that, of course. But at the same time, there are certain things which one needs to say. So it's a matter of really, in that, a principle which a state has a right to pass laws, that there be no discrimination against homosexual people, right. But also, they mustn't, in passing such laws, discriminate also against religious bodies such as the Catholic Church in following out for the common good and in an excellent way the way in which their principles underlying their good work. Then the other point is, of course, about schools, and that we would very much value our Catholic schools, who are an important part of the not just the education of Catholic children, but also, we believe, to the common good again, because people, young children and young men and women, receive excellent education at Catholic schools. Excellent education not only for themselves, but also in the sense that they contribute to the common good. They're brought in to be good citizens, to be open to the development of the good of our country. So I wouldn't like the Prime Minister or his government to say, well, let's diminish, take away Catholic schools, church schools, because there are voices that say that there shouldn't be any, and the government won't support them. I think they'd be very foolish to go in that direction. The new Prime Minister, and I've met him a number of times now, I have a great admiration for him, for his dedication especially to relieving the poverty of not just of children, but of people not only at home, but abroad, particularly in Africa. And in many ways, he's shown himself willing to go out of the way to say, this is a very, very big priority for me. It would be nice to think that he can make Britain a model of how rich countries can contribute much more than they have done of their gross product for the sake of the poorest in the world, particularly in Africa, but elsewhere as well. And he's gone on record as saying that he's very much a priority. So I'm hopeful for the new office, which he inherits. He has at least 2 years or more before he need call an election. So we'll see what he's going to do. But I think, on the whole, that he's the best choice, certainly, of the Labour Party. He's got in up unopposed. Therefore, I think the future is on his side at the moment. And my prayers and my good wishes go with him.
He is the son of a minister, isn't he, a Scottish minister. Do you think faith plays an important part in his life?
I don't know about his personal religious practice or sentiments. I cannot but think that some of the Scotch Presbyterian convictions reside somewhere in his soul. How he brings that out in his life, through prayer or practice, I don't really know, and I haven't talked about it with him. But the Scots, you know, have that kind of, it's in some ways slightly a forbidding religiosity, you know. But what I like about it is that there's no nonsense about it. You know, this is a serious business, religion. And what I want, and it's very interesting in Britain at the moment, religion has been taken more seriously. And some of the attacks on religion by the atheists who've written books about God and religion and trying to deny it has only made religion in a way more prominent, make people think, well, there is something about religion which is important to life, something about faith that animates the people. And with regard to the Catholic community, I think it wakes up the Catholic community as well. If you're going to be a Catholic or a Christian in today's society, you shouldn't be a passive one. You've got to be one who witnesses to your faith by your prayer, by in your home, in the family, but also in public life, in any way that's open to you. And that's what I would hope for our Catholic community in Britain in the years ahead.
Again, there's been some tensions, hasn't there, between, as you say, private convictions, private religious convictions, and the way in which politicians are exercising these in the public sphere.
Well, there has, yes. I've mentioned the two recent ones. And it is a strange culture at the moment. And I suppose what we're asking for is for Christians, people of other faiths, to be free to exercise their freedom in terms of what they believe, how they act, in the public space. Not to be privatized, not to be put in the periphery of society. That would be disastrous. And the fact of the matter in Britain, as indeed other parts of Europe, there's still a Christian heritage, even though people don't practice their Christianity. But I notice that people in Britain, certainly always since my time of 30 years as a bishop, but particularly, of course, since I've come to Westminster, that people may not agree with the Catholic voice, but they accept the right of the Catholic voice to be heard and wouldn't want it not heard. There might be an aggressive group of secularists who'd say, no, we don't want to hear it at all. But I don't think that's true of the majority of people in Britain.
We've also seen Catholic politicians, though, over in particular the abortion legislation, saying that while their private views are one thing, their pragmatic political views may not necessarily be in line with church teaching, and this has caused problems with voices calling for them to be excluded, for example, from communion.
I think that it would be not right for bishops to say anybody who voted this way or that should be excluded from excommunicated. But I do think Catholic politicians have a duty to examine their conscience, to be informed about their faith and to act on that conscience. Now, how they do so is a decision they make. But I think bishops have got to be careful not to intrude too much into the political sphere, but should urge Catholic politicians, as I do, to, as I say, to be informed about their faith, to examine their conscience and to act according to it.
You've also been recently chatting with the outgoing Prime Minister, of course, Tony Blair. Yes. What would you say, if you had to perhaps sum up in some way his legacy to the country over the past 10 years, what would that be?
It's been a remarkable 10 years, really. And Tony Blair, whom I know quite well now, is a remarkable politician. His legacy to the country is perhaps, well, like most things, negative and positive. The positive is that I think people are rather not unhappy to live in that kind of society that Britain is today, and some of it is that due to his kind of attitude of letting people free to act as they think right. I think also there is the legacy of, as often people noted, his hard work, devoted work for the solution in Northern Ireland, which was a really great tribute to him. And then other work in Africa, and also, I mean, I think that although he wasn't able to do it, and in fact I wish he could have done more for the European community, he was up against quite a lot of opposition on that. But I think his heart is with making Britain have a strong and constructive voice in Europe, and I, for one, would heartily support that. Of course, the negative aspects, everyone will, of course, blame him for the Iraq war, and should he have done it? Then there's the whole question of some of the loosening of laws in England, and perhaps some of the laws which have been passed could have been more expressive, rather than trying to pass laws for every situation. Concentrate on the positive, if you like, whether it's in family life, whether it's in industry, whether it's in health, rather than try and solve every difficulty that comes up. But on the whole, he's left Britain economically healthy, socially so-so, religiously, you can't blame Tony Blair for a decline in religion. You have to sort of blame people like me, I suppose, and others for that. But I think that what has happened in his 10 years is that somehow or other, the secularism that's become so much part of society has made Christians, and in particular Catholics, suddenly realize that you can't swim with the stream. You've got to swim against the stream in our culture today. And I also think that Tony Blair would be very much in tune with what the Holy Father says about the link between reason and faith and culture, and that you can't have a proper dialogue with people unless you're going to do so on a basis of reason and in faith, indeed, within the culture in which you live. And I think in his new job for the Middle East, I think it's a very exciting and challenging task for him, and we all, I think, wish him well.
There's a lot of interest, of course, in his purported interest in the Catholic Church. Can you say anything about that at all?
I wouldn't want to say any more, really, than he's done himself. I mean, he goes to Mass every Sunday. He prays. He is his wife, as you know, is a Catholic, and his children. So it's not surprising that people would think maybe he will enter into full communion with the Catholic Church. I think it's a private matter. I think it's a personal matter. And I think he will tell us when and if he wants to make that step.
My thanks there to the Archbishop of Westminster, Cardinal Cormac Murphy O'Connor. Colourful parades and more sombre protests mark the 10th anniversary of Hong Kong's handover from British to Chinese rule on Sunday. Chinese President Hu Jintao was guest of honour at the official celebrations. He hailed the success of the so-called Two Systems, One Country arrangement, whereby the thriving capitalist territory has kept a high degree of economic and political independence as a special administrative region of its communist-ruled neighbour. However, while Hong Kong ranks as the freest economy in the world, many of its inhabitants were out on the streets on Sunday protesting about the lack of progress towards greater democracy, in particular the right of universal suffrage for the election of its governor or chief executive.
We do have a modicum of democracy, but not what more people would like to see, namely universal suffrage for the chief executive.
Maryknoll Father Peter Barry works at the Holy Spirit Study Centre in Hong Kong, which analyses the changes in mainland China, especially regarding the Catholic Church there. I asked him how ordinary people in Hong Kong have been marking this anniversary.
The ordinary people of Hong Kong, they're happy that Hong Kong has gone back to China, and they're proud of being Chinese, but they're also very independent, and they think in terms of Hong Kong, and they are Cantonese speaking, whereas the mainlanders are mostly Mandarin speakers, and so they do have that cultural difference. But I just think they're taking things as they go. As I detected, they're not very excited about the 10th anniversary. It's a milestone, but they're just happy that their way of life hasn't changed very much in the last 10 years.
There was, of course, a lot of concern, wasn't there, that independence you're talking about would be eroded, that there would be major changes. You're saying, really, that those fears were unfounded.
Yes. Generally, that's the case. Well, what shall I say? Business goes on as usual between the two cities. Trade and development keeps growing. They talk about the Delta, Pearl River Delta, and how it's growing economically very well, between the two areas. So and that part of life continues on, and the stock market is growing by leaps and bounds, both in Hong Kong and the mainland. Everyone seems to be doing well economically.
Within the church as well, there was concern, wasn't there, before the handover, that religious freedoms would in some way be curtailed. Would you say those fears were unfounded as well, that there hasn't really been much change to the life of the church in Hong Kong over the past decade?
No, there hasn't. There hasn't been religious freedom. We are free here in Hong Kong to practice our faith as Catholics. Of course, other areas of religious freedom are also preserved. Freedom of the press, freedom to demonstrate. In fact, on July 1st, there will be a demonstration. In addition to celebrating the 10 years of the handover, people will be marching for more democracy in Hong Kong. Universal suffrage for the chief executive, which has not taken place yet. There are democratic elections for 20 or 30 seats. I think it's more like 20 in the Legislative Council out of 60. So you do have a modicum of democracy, but not what more people would like to see, namely universal suffrage for the chief executive. But religiously, fine. Our bishop, our cardinal, as you know, is able to speak out. People may not like it, but he's able to be a voice for the right of abode for children of people who live in Hong Kong, if their children are on the mainland, and many other issues of human rights.
This anniversary of the handover to Chinese rule came just one day after the Vatican made public a letter from Pope Benedict XVI to Chinese Catholics, aimed at promoting cooperation between underground communities of believers and those officially registered with the so-called Patriotic Association. The document, accompanied by a note from the Vatican Press Office, reiterated the Holy See's willingness to establish diplomatic ties with Beijing and invited Chinese authorities to engage in serious dialogue over long-standing difficulties, including the appointment of bishops. In the letter, Pope Benedict acknowledges the suffering that Chinese Catholics have endured, especially those who have practiced their faith underground in order to maintain their loyalty to the Holy See. Father Peter Barry in Hong Kong explains how the underground church in China developed over the decades in response to the government-controlled Catholic Patriotic Association.
The main thing, as we see it in our position of freedom of religion here, one country, two systems, we're completely free like the rest of the world to practice our faith. But the in China, of course, you have supervision, the control of government bodies like the Religious Affairs Bureau and within the church itself, an external structure called the Patriotic Association, which controls the church. And so this is what has happened with the development of those things. When China reopened in 1978 or 9, and brought back religion, the way I see it, they should have left off those old structures. And, you know, they were disbanded with the Cultural Revolution, but no, they brought them back. They brought back the Patriotic Association. They brought back the Religious Affairs Bureau. And these are controlling the religion in China, you know, and of all religions, not just the Catholic faith, but these groups are above the bishops, you would say, above the bishops' conference, for instance, the Patriotic Association is. And so you have laymen ruling the clergy. So there you have an underground church as a response to that. People do not want government control in the church. They want real freedom of religion. And so this gives rise to the underground church. They would rather worship privately than go to the official churches.
We know that there are diplomatic negotiations going on between the Vatican and Chinese authorities to try and overcome these problems, problems of the right of the Vatican to name bishops to the church. Do you expect developments here in the fairly near future or not?
You would hope, you know, in your heart of hearts, hope that negotiations could take place and these questions could be ironed out. For instance, the appointment of bishops is probably the biggest one. I don't know why people from both sides are not able to sit down and discuss these questions. They've been worked out with other communist-ruled countries in the past. We think of Cardinal Casseroli in the 1960s working with the countries of Eastern Europe. But that hasn't been the case with China yet. Maybe I think China wants to get the Olympics out of the way first. There's also a party congress this year in the fall. Probably they want to see who the new leadership will be. Maybe after 2008 we can look for something.
My thanks there to Mary Knoll Father Peter Barry of the Holy Spirit Study Centre in Hong Kong. And on the English programme over the next few days, we'll be taking a closer look at that letter from Pope Benedict XVI to Catholics in China, hearing reactions from Catholic leaders in the region. For the moment, that's all from me, Philippa Hitchin, and from all of us here at the English programme for today. Stay tuned to Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.